There was another low rumble from the south this time.
Thunder, Silt said, looking a bit puzzled. Is this not an odd time of year for it?
This plain breeds peculiar weather, Belgareth replied. There isn't anything between here and Dresnia but 800 leagues of grass.
Do we try for the Vale, then?
Barak asked. It looks as if we will have to, the old man replied.
Durnick came back down the hill.
They're coming across the river, he reported. Well, they aren't spreading out yet. Looks as if they want to get more men across before they start looking for us.
How hard can we push the horses without hurting them? Silk asked him.
Not very, Durnick replied. It would be better to save them until we absolutely have to use up whatever they've got left. If we walk and lead them for an hour or so, we might be able to get a canter out of them, for short periods of time.
Let's go along the back side of this crest, Belgareth said, picking up the reins of his horse. We will stay pretty much out of sight that way. But I want to keep an eye on Tar Urgos.
He led them at an angle back up out of the swale. The clouds had broken even more now, and the tatters raced in the endless winds that swept the vast grassland. To the east, the sky was turning a pale pink. Although the Algerian plain did not have that bitter, arid chill that had cut at them in the uplands of Thol Murgos and Mishrek Ak Thol, it was still very cold. Geryon shivered, drew his cloak in tight about him, and kept walking, trailing his weary horse behind him. There was another brief rumble, and the little boy, perched in the saddle of Aunt Paul's horse, laughed.
Errand,
he announced.
I wish he would stop that, Silk said irritably.
They glanced from time to time over the crest of the long hill as they walked. Below, in the broad valley of the Aldur River, the Murgos of Tar Urgos were fording in larger and larger groups. It appeared that full half of his army had reached the west bank by now, and the red and black standard of the King of the Murgos stood planted defiantly on Algerian soil.
If he brings too many more men down that escarpment, it's going to take something pretty significant to dislodge him,
Barak rumbled, scowling down at the Murgos.
I know, Belgareth replied. And that's the one thing I've wanted to avoid. We are not ready for war just yet.
The sun, huge and red, ponderously moved up from behind the eastern escarpment, turning the sky around it rosy. In the still-shadowed valley below them, the Murgos continued to splash across the river in the steely morning light.
Methinks he will wait the sun before he begins the search for us, Mandaralan observed.
Yes, and that's not very far off, Barak agreed, glancing at the slowly moving band of sunlight just touching the hill along which they were moving. We've probably got half an hour at the most. I think it's getting to the point where we're going to have to gamble on these horses. Maybe if we switch mounts every mile or so, we can get some more distance out of them.
The rumble that came then could not possibly have been thunder. The ground shook with it, and it rolled on and on endlessly from both the north and the south. Then, pouring over the crests of the hills surrounding the valley of the Aldur like some vast tide suddenly released by the bursting of a mighty dam, came the clans of the Algars. Down they plunged upon the startled Murgos thickly clustered along the banks of the river, and their great war cry shook the very heavens as they fell like wolves upon the divided army of Tar Urgos. A lone horseman veered out of the great charge of the clans and came pounding up the hillside toward Geryon and his friends. As the warrior drew closer, Geryon could see his long scalp lock flowing behind him, and his drawn saber catching the first rays of the morning sun. It was Hetar. A vast surge of relief swept over Geryon. They were safe.
"Where have you been?"
Barak demanded in a great voice, as the hawk-faced Algar rode closer.
"Watching,"
Hetar replied calmly, as he reined in.
We wanted to let the Murkos get out a ways from the escarpment, so we could cut them off. My father sent me to see how you all are.
Oh, how considerate, Silk observed sardonically.
Did it ever occur to you to let us know that you were out there?
Hetar shrugged.
We could see that you were all right.
He looked critically at their exhausted mounts.
You did not take very good care of them, he said accusingly.
We were a bit pressed, Durnick apologized.
Did you get the orb?
The tall man asked Velgarath, glancing hungrily down toward the river where a vast battle had been joined.
It took a bit, but we got it,
the old sorcerer replied.
Good.
Hetar turned his horse, and his lean face had a fierce look on it.
I will tell Kohag. Will you excuse me?
And then he stopped, as if remembering something.
Oh,
he said to Barak.
Congratulations, by the way.
For what?
The big man asked, looking puzzled.
The birth of your son.
What?
Barak sounded stunned.
How?
In the usual way, I would imagine,
Hetar replied.
I mean, how did you find out?
Anheg sent word to us.
When was he born?
A couple of months ago.
Hetar looked nervously down at the battle, which was raging now on both sides of the river, and in the middle of the ford as well.
I really have to go. If I do not hurry, there will not be any Murgos left.
And he drove his heels into his horse's flanks and plunged down the hill. He hasn't changed a bit, Silk noted. Barak was standing with a somewhat foolish grin on his big red-bearded face.
Congratulations, my lord,
Mandarallan said to him, clasping his hand. Barak's grin grew broader. It quickly became obvious that the situation of the encircled Murgos below was hopeless. With his army cut in two by the river, Torogos was unable to mount even an orderly retreat. The forces he had brought across the river were quickly swarmed under by King Kohag's superior numbers, and the few survivors of that short, ugly melee plunged back into the river, protectively drawn up around the red and black banner of the Murgo King. Even in the ford, however, the Algar warriors pressed him. Some distance upriver, Geryon could see horsemen plunging into the icy water to be carried down by the current to the shallows of the ford in an effort to cut off escape. Much of the fight in the river was obscured by the sheets of spray kicked up by struggling horses, but the bodies floating downstream testified to the savagery of the clash. Briefly, for no more than a moment, the red and black banner of Tar-Ugos was confronted by the burgundy and white horse banner of King Kohag, and then the two were swept apart.
Oh, that could have been an interesting meeting, Silk noted. Kohag and Tar-Ugos have hated each other for years.
Once the King of the Murgos regained the east bank, he rallied what forces he could, turned, and fled back across the open grassland toward the escarpment, with Algar clansmen hotly pursuing him. For the bulk of his army, however, there was no escape. Since their horses had not yet descended the narrow ravine from the top of the escarpment, they were forced to fight on foot. The Algars swept down upon them in waves, sabers flashing in the morning sun. Faintly, Geryon could hear the screams. Sickened finally, he turned away, unable to watch the slaughter any longer. The little boy, who was standing close beside Aunt Paul with his hand in hers, looked at Geryon gravely.
Erend,
he said with a sad conviction. By mid-morning, the battle was over. The last of the Murgos on the far bank of the river had been destroyed, and Tar-Urgos had fled with the tattered remnants of his army back up the ravine.
Good fight,
Barak observed professionally, looking down at the bodies littering both banks of the river and bobbing limply in the shallows downstream from the ford.
The tactics of thine Algar cousins were masterly, Mandarallan agreed. Tar-Ugos will take some time to recover from this morning's chastisement.
I'd give a great deal to see the look on his face just now, Silk laughed. He's probably frothing at the mouth.
King Kohag, dressed in steel-plated black leather, and with his horse banner streaming triumphantly in the bright morning sun, came galloping up the hill toward them, closely surrounded by the members of his personal guard.
"Interesting morning,"
he said with typical Algar understatement as he reined in.
"Thanks for bringing us so many Murgos."
"He's as bad as Hetar," Silk observed to Barak.
The king of the Algars grinned openly as he slowly dismounted. His weak legs seemed almost to buckle as he carefully put his weight on them, and he held onto his saddle for support.
"How did things go in Rakhthol?"
he asked.
"It wound up being rather noisy," Belgarath replied. "Did you find Tuchik in good health?"
"Moderately.
We corrected that, however. The whole affair set off an earthquake. Most of Rakhthal slid off its mountaintop, I'm afraid."
Kohag grinned again.
"Oh, what a shame." "Where's Hetar?"
Barak asked.
"Chasing Murgos, I imagine," Kohag replied. "Their rear guard got cut off, and they are out there trying to find some place to hide." "There aren't very many hiding places on this plain, are there?"
Barak asked.
"Almost none at all,"
the Algar king agreed pleasantly. A dozen or so Algar wagons crested a nearby hill, rolling toward them through the tall brown grass. They were square-boxed conveyances, looking not unlike houses on wheels. They had roofs, narrow windows, and steps at the rear, leading up to the doorway on the back of each wagon. It looked, Garion thought, almost like a moving city as they approached.
"I imagine Hetar's going to be a while," Kohag noted. "Why don't we have a bit of lunch? I would like to get word to Anheg and Rodar about what's happened here as soon as possible. But I am sure you'll want to pass a few things along as well. We can talk while we eat."
Several of the wagons were drawn up close together, and their sides were let down and joined to form a spacious, low-ceilinged dining hall. Braziers provided warmth, and candles illuminated the interior of the quickly assembled hall, supplementing the bright winter sunlight streaming in through the windows. They dined on roasted meat and mellow ale. Garion soon found that he was wearing far too many clothes. It seemed that he had not been warm in months, and the glowing braziers shimmered out a welcomed heat. Although he was tired and very dirty, he felt warm and safe, and he soon found himself nodding over his plate, almost drowsing, as Belgareth recounted the story of their escape to the Algar king. Gradually, however, as the old man spoke, something alerted Garion. There was, it seemed, a trace too much vivacity in his grandfather's voice, and Belgareth's words sometimes seemed almost to tumble over each other. His blue eyes were very bright, but seemed occasionally a bit unfocused.
"So, Zedar got away," Kohag was saying. "That is the only thing that mars this whole affair." "Zedar is no problem,"
Belgareth replied, smiling in a slightly dazed way. His voice seemed strange, uncertain, and King Kohag looked at the old man curiously.
"You have had a busy year, Belgarath." "A good one, though."
The sorcerer smiled again and lifted his ale cup. His hand was trembling violently, and he stared at it in astonishment.
"Aunt Paul," Garion called urgently. "Are you all right, father?"
"Fine, Paul. Perfectly fine."
He smiled vaguely at her, his unfocused eyes blinking owlishly. He rose suddenly to his feet and began to move toward her, but his steps were lurching, almost staggering, and then his eyes rolled back in his head and he fell to the floor like a pole-axed cow.
"Father?"
Aunt Paul exclaimed, leaping to his side. Garion, moving almost as fast as his aunt,
knelt on the other side of the unconscious old man.
"What's wrong with him?"
he demanded. But Aunt Paul did not answer. Her hands were at Belgorath's wrist and brow, feeling for his pulse. She peeled back one of his eyelids and stared intently into his blank, unseeing eyes.
"Dernick,"
she snapped.
"Get my herb bag, quickly."
The smith bolted for the door. King Kohag had half risen, his face deathly pale.
"He is not..."
"No,"
she answered tensely.
"He is alive, but only barely."
"Is something attacking him?" Silk was on his feet, looking around wildly, his hand unconsciously on his dagger.
"No, it's nothing like that."
Aunt Paul's hands had moved to the old man's chest.
"I should have known,"
she berated herself.
"This stubborn, proud old fool. I should have been watching him. Please, Aunt Paul,"
Geryon begged desperately.
"What's wrong with him?"
"He never really recovered from his fight with Tuchik," she replied. "He's been forcing himself, drawing on his will. And then those rocks in the ravine. But he wouldn't quit. Now he has burned up all of his vital energy and will. He barely has enough strength left to keep breathing."
Geryon had lifted his grandfather's head and cradled it on his lap.
"Help me, Geryon."
He knew instinctively what she wanted. He gathered his will and held out his hand to her. She grasped it quickly, and he felt the force surging out of him. Her eyes were very wide as she intently watched the old man's face.
"Again."
And once more she pulled the quickly gathered will out of him.
"What are we doing?"
Geryon's voice was shrill.
"Trying to replace some of what he's lost. Maybe."
She glanced toward the door.
"Hurry, Dernick!"
she shouted. Dernick rushed back into the wagon.
"Open the bag,"
she instructed.
"Give me that black jar, the one that's sealed with lead, and a pair of iron tongs."
"Should I open the jar, Mistress Paul?" the smith asked.
"No. Just break the seal, carefully, and give me a glove. Leather, if you can find one."
Wordlessly, Silk pulled a leather gauntlet from under his belt and handed it to her. She pulled it on, opened the black jar, and reached inside with the tongs. With great care, she removed a single, dark, oily-looking green leaf. She held it very carefully in the tongs.
"Pry his mouth open, Geryon."
Geryon wedged his fingers between Belgareth's clenched teeth and carefully pried the old man's jaws apart. Aunt Paul pulled down her father's lower lip, reached inside his mouth with the shiny leaf, and lightly brushed his tongue with it, once, and once only. Belgorath jumped violently, and his feet suddenly scraped on the floor. His muscles heaved, and his arms began to flail about.
"Hold him down," Aunt Paul commanded.
She pulled back sharply and held the leaf out of the way while Mandarallan and Barak jumped in to hold down Belgorath's convulsing body.
"Give me a bowl," she ordered. "A wooden one."
Dernick handed her one, and she deposited the leaf and the tongs in it. Then, with great care, she took off the gauntlet and laid it atop the leaf.
"Take this," she told the smith. "Do not touch any part of the glove."
"What do you want me to do with it, Mistress Paul?"
"Take it out and burn it, bowl and all, and do not let anyone get into the smoke from it."
"Is it that dangerous?" Silk asked.
"It is even worse. But those are the only precautions we can take out here."
Dernick swallowed very hard and left the wagon, holding the bowl as if it were a live snake. Polgara took a small mortar and pestle and began grinding certain herbs from her bag into a fine powder as she watched Belgrath intently.
"How far is it to the stronghold, Kohag?"
she asked the Algar king.
"A man on a good horse could make it in half a day," he replied.
"How long by wagon? A wagon driven carefully to avoid bouncing."
2 days,
she frowned, still mixing the herbs in the mortar.
"All right. There's no help for it, I guess. Please send Hetar to Queen Silar. Have him tell her that I'm going to need a warm, well-lighted chamber with a good bed and no drafts. Dernick, I want you to drive the wagon. Do not hit any bumps, even if it means losing an hour."
The smith nodded.
"He's going to be all right, isn't he?"
Berek asked, his voice strained and his face shocked by Belgorath's sudden collapse.
"It's really too early to say," she replied. "He has been on the point of collapse for days, maybe, but he would not let himself go. I think he has passed this crisis, but there may be others."
She laid one hand on her father's chest.
"Put him in bed, carefully. Then I want a screen of some kind around the bed. Blankets will do. We have to keep him very quiet and out of drafts. No loud noises."
They all stared at her as the significance of her extreme precaution struck them.
"Move, gentlemen," she told them firmly. "His life may depend on certain speed."
Chapter 6. The wagon seemed barely to crawl. The high, thin cloud had swept in again to hide the sun, and a kind of leaden chill descended on the featureless plain of southern Algeria. Geryon rode inside the wagon, thick-headed and numb with exhaustion, watching with dreadful concern as Aunt Paul hovered over the unconscious Belgorath. Sleep was out of the question. Another crisis could arise at any time, and he had to be ready to leap to her aid, joining his will and the power of his amulet with hers. Erand, his small face grave, sat quietly in a chair at the far side of the wagon, his hands firmly clasped around the pouch Durnick had made for him. The sound of the orb still hung in Geryon's ears, muted but continual. He had grown almost accustomed to the song in the weeks since they had left Rakthal, but at quiet moments, or when he was tired, it always seemed to return with a renewed strength. It was somehow a comforting sound. Aunt Paul leaned forward to touch Belgorath's chest.
"What's wrong?" Geryon asked in a sharp whisper. "Nothing's wrong, Geryon," she replied calmly. "Please don't keep saying that every time I so much as move. If something is wrong, I will tell you. I'm just worried, that's all."
She turned and gave him a steady look.
"Why don't you take Erend and go up and ride on top of the wagon with Silk and Durnick?" "But what if you need me?"
"I'll call you, dear."
"I'd really rather stay, Aunt Paul."
"I'd really rather you didn't. I'll call if I need you."
"But now, Geryon?"
Geryon knew better than to argue. He took Erend out the back door of the wagon and up the steps to the top.
"How is he?"
Silk asked.
"How should I know? All I know is that she chased me out."
Geryon's reply was a bit surly.
"That might be a good sign, you know."
"Maybe."
Geryon looked around. Off to the west there was a range of low hills. Rearing above them stood a vast pile of rock.
"Algar's stronghold," Durnick told Geryon, pointing.
"Are we that close?"
"That's still a good day's ride."
"How high is it?"
400 or 500 feet at least," Silk told him. "The Algars have been building at it for several thousand years. It gives them something to do after the calving season."
Berek rode up.
"Who's Belgorath?"
he asked as he approached.
"I think he might be improving just a little," Geryon answered. "I don't know for sure, though."
"Well, that's something, anyway."
The big man pointed toward a gully just ahead.
"You had better go around that," he told Durnick. "King Kohag says that the ground gets a bit rough through there."
Durnick nodded and changed the wagon's direction. Throughout the day, the stronghold of the Algars loomed higher and higher against the western horizon. It was a vast, towering fortress rearing out of the dun-colored hills.
"A monument to an idea that got out of hand," Silk observed as he lounged idly atop the wagon.
"I don't quite follow that," Durnick said.
"Algars are nomads," the little man explained. "They live in wagons, like this one, and follow their herds. The stronghold gives Murgo raiders something to attack. That's its only real purpose. Very practical, really. It is much easier than looking for them all over these plains. The Murgos always come here, and it is a convenient place to wipe them out."
Don't the Murgos realize that? Dernick looked a bit skeptical.
Quite possibly. But they come here anyway, because they cannot resist the place. They simply cannot accept the fact that nobody really lives here.
Silk grinned his ferret-like little grin. You know how stubborn Murgos are.
Anyway, over the years, the Algar clans have developed a sort of competition. Every year they try to outdo one another in hauling rock, and the stronghold keeps growing higher and higher.
Did Kal Torak really lay siege to it for 8 years? Geryon asked him.
Silk nodded.
They say that his army was like a sea of Angoraks dashing itself to pieces against the walls of the stronghold. They might still be here, but they ran out of food. That's always been the problem with large armies. Any fool can raise an army, but you start running into trouble around supper time.
As they approached the man-made mountain, the gates opened and a party emerged to greet them. In the lead on a white palfrey rode Queen Silar with Hetar close behind. At a certain point, they stopped and sat waiting. Geryon lifted a small trap door in the roof of the wagon.
"We're here, Aunt Paul," he reported.
"Good,"
she replied.
"How's Grandfather?" "He's sleeping. His breathing seems a bit stronger. Go ask Kohag to take us inside immediately. I want to get Father into a warm bed as soon as possible."
"Yes, Aunt Paul."
Geryon lowered the trapdoor and then went down the steps at the rear of the slowly moving wagon. He untied his horse, mounted, and rode to the front of the column, where the Algar Queen was quietly greeting her husband.
"Excuse me," he said respectfully, swinging down from his horse, "but Aunt Paul wants to get Belgarath inside at once."
"How is he?" Hetar asked.
"Aunt Paul says that his breathing's getting stronger, but she's still worried."
From the rear of the group that had emerged from the stronghold, there was a flurry of small hooves. The colt that had been born in the hills above Metagor burst into view and came charging directly at them. Geryon immediately found himself swarmed under by the colt's exuberant greetings. The small horse nuzzled him and butted at him with its head, then pranced away, only to gallop back again. When Geryon put his hand on the animal's neck to calm him, the colt quivered with joy at his touch.
"He has been waiting for you," Hetar said to Geryon. "He seems to have known that you were coming."
The wagon drew up and stopped. The door opened, and Aunt Paul looked out.
"Everything is ready, Pogra," Queen Silar told her.
"Thank you, Silar. Is he recovering at all?"
"He seems better, but it's very hard to say for sure at this point."
Erand, who had been watching from the top of the wagon, suddenly clambered down the steps at the rear, hopped to the ground, and ran out along the legs of the horses.
"Catch him, Geryon," Aunt Paul said. "I think he had better ride in here with me until we get inside the stronghold."
As Geryon started after the little boy, the colt scampered away, and Erend, laughing with delight, ran after him.
"Erend!"
Geryon called sharply. The colt, however, had turned in mid-gallop and suddenly bore down on the child, his hooves flailing wildly. Erend showed no signs of alarm, stood smiling directly in its path. Startled, the little horse stiffened his legs and skidded to a stop. Erend laughed and held out his hand. The colt's eyes were wide as he sniffed curiously at the hand, and then the boy touched the small animal's face. Again within the vaults of his mind, Geryon seemed to hear that strange bell-like note, and the dry voice murmured,
"Done,"
with a peculiar sort of satisfaction.
"What's that supposed to mean?" Geryon asked silently. But there was no answer.
He shrugged and picked Erend up to avoid any chance collision between horse and child. The colt stood staring at the two of them, its eyes wide as if in amazement. When Geryon turned to carry Erend back to the wagon, it trotted alongside, sniffing and even nuzzling at the child. Geryon wordlessly handed Erend up to Aunt Paul and looked her full in the face. She said nothing as she took the child,
but her expression told him plainly that something very important had just happened. As he turned to remount his horse, he felt that someone was watching him, and he turned quickly toward the group of riders that had accompanied Queen Sila from the stronghold. Just behind the queen was a tall girl mounted on a roan horse. She had long, dark brown hair, and the eyes she had fixed on Geryon were gray, calm, and very serious. Her horse pranced nervously, and she calmed him with a quiet word and a gentle touch. Then she turned to gaze openly at Geryon again. He had the peculiar feeling that he ought to know her. The wagon creaked as Durnik shook the reins to start the team, and they all followed King Kohag and Queen Silar through a narrow gate into the stronghold. Geryon saw immediately that there were no buildings inside the towering fortress. Instead, there was a maze of stone walls, perhaps 20 feet high, twisting this way and that without any apparent plan.
"But where is thy city, Your Majesty?"
Mandarallan asked in perplexity.
"Inside the walls themselves," King Kohag replied. "They are thick enough and high enough to give us all of the room we could possibly need."
"But what purpose has all of this, then?"
"It is just a trap," the king shrugged. "We permit attackers to break through the gates, and then we deal with them in here." "We want to go this way."
He led them along a narrow alleyway. They dismounted in a courtyard beside the vast wall. Barak and Hetar unhooked the latches and swung the side of the wagon down. Barak tugged thoughtfully at his beard as he looked at the sleeping Belgarath.
"It would probably disturb him less if we just took him inside, bed and all."
"Right," Hetar agreed, and the two of them climbed up into the wagon to lift out the sorcerer's bed.
"Just don't bounce him around," Polgara cautioned, "and do not drop him."
"We've got him, Polgara," Barak assured her. "I know you might not believe it, but we're almost as concerned about him as you are."
With the two big men carrying the bed, they passed through an arched doorway into a wide, torch-lighted corridor, and up a flight of stairs, then along another hallway to another flight.
"Is it much farther?"
Barak asked. Sweat was running down his face into his beard now.
"This bed is not getting any lighter, you know."
"Just up here,"
the Algar Queen told him.
"I hope he appreciates all of this when he wakes up," Barak grumbled.
The room to which they carried Belgarath was large and airy. A glowing brazier stood in each corner, and a broad window overlooked the maze inside the walls of the stronghold. A canopied bed stood against one wall, and a large wooden tub against the other.
"This will be just fine," Polgara said approvingly. "Thank you, Silar."
"We love him too, Polgara,"
Queen Silar replied quietly. Polgara drew the drapes, darkening the room. Then she turned back the covers, and Belgarath was transferred to the canopied bed so smoothly that he did not even stir.
"He looks a little better," Silk said.
"He needs sleep, rest, and quiet, more than anything right now,"
Polgara told him, her eyes intent on the old man's sleeping face.
"We will leave you with him, Polgara,"
Queen Silar said. She turned to the rest of them.
"Why don't we all go down to the main hall? Supper is nearly ready. But in the meantime, I'll have some ale brought in."
Barak's eyes brightened noticeably, and he started toward the door.
"Barak," Polgara called to him, "aren't you and Hetar forgetting something?"
She looked pointedly at the bed they had used for a stretcher. Barak sighed. He and Hetar picked up the bed again.
"I'll send some supper for you, Polgara,"
the queen said.
"Thank you, Silar."
Aunt Paul turned to Geryon then, her eyes grave.
"Stay for a few moments, dear,"
she asked, and he remained as the others all quietly left.
"Close the door, Geryon,"
she said, pulling a chair up beside the sleeping old man's bed. He shut the door and crossed the room back to her.
"Is he really getting better, Aunt Paul?"
She nodded.
I think we are past the immediate danger. He seems stronger physically. But it's not his physical body that I am worried about. It's his mind. That's why I wanted to talk to you alone.
Geryon felt a sudden cold grip of fear.
His mind? Keep your voice down, dear, she told him quietly. This has to be kept strictly between us.
Her eyes were still on Belgarath's face.
An episode like this can have very serious effects, and there is no way to know how he will be when he recovers. He could be very seriously weakened.
Weakened? How?
His will could be greatly reduced to that of any other old man. He drained it to the utter limit. He might have gone so far that he will never regain his powers.
You mean he wouldn't be a sorcerer anymore?
Don't repeat the obvious, Geryon. If that happens, it's going to be up to you and to me to conceal it from everybody. Your grandfather's power is the one thing that has held the Angoraks in check for all of these years. If something has happened to that power, then you and I will have to make it look as if he's the same as he always was. We'll have to conceal the truth even from him, if that's possible.
What can we do without him?
We would go on, Geryon, she replied quietly, looking directly into his eyes. Our task is too important for us to falter because a man falls by the wayside, even if that man happens to be your grandfather. We are racing against time in all of this. We absolutely must fulfill the prophecy and get the orb back to Rhea by Aristide. And there are people who must be gathered up to go with us.
Who?
Princess Synedra, for one.
Synedra?
Geryon had never really forgotten the little princess, but he failed to see why Aunt Paul was making such an issue of her going with them to Rhea.
In time you will understand, dear. All of this is part of a series of events that must occur in proper sequence, and at the proper time. In most situations, the present is determined by the past. This series of events is different, however. In this case, what is happening in the present is determined by the future. If we do not get it exactly the way it's supposed to be, the ending will be different, and I don't think any of us would like that at all.
What do you want me to do?
He asked, placing himself unquestioningly in her hands. She smiled gratefully at him.
Thank you, Geryon. When you rejoin the others, they are going to ask you how Father is coming along, and I want you to put on your best face and tell them that he's doing fine.
You want me to lie to them?
No place in the world is safe from spies, Geryon. You know that as well as I. And no matter what happens, we can't let any hint that Father might not recover fully get back to the Angoraks. If necessary, you will lie until your tongue turns black. The whole fate of the West could depend on how well you do it.
He stared at her.
It's possible that all this is totally unnecessary, she reassured him. He may be exactly the same as always after he's had a week or two of rest. But we've got to be ready to move smoothly, just in case he's not.
Can't we do something?
We are doing all that we can. Go back to the others now. And smile, Geryon. Smile until your jaws ache, if you have to.
There was a faint sound in the corner of the room, and they both turned sharply. Erend, his blue eyes very serious, stood watching them.
Take him with you, Aunt Paul said. See that he eats, and keep an eye on him.
Geryon nodded, and beckoned to the child. Erend smiled his trusting smile and crossed the room. He reached out and patted the unconscious Belgarath's hand, then turned to follow Geryon from the room. The tall, brown-haired girl who had accompanied Queen Selar out through the gates of the stronghold was waiting for him in the corridor outside. Her skin, Geryon noticed, was very pale, almost translucent, and her gray eyes were direct.
"Is the Eternal Man really any better?"
she asked.
"Much better," Geryon replied with all of the confidence he could muster.
He'll be out of bed in no time at all.
He seems so weak, she said. So odd and frail.
Frail? Belgarath? Geryon forced a laugh. He's made out of old iron and horseshoe nails.
He is 7,000 years old, after all.
That doesn't mean anything to him. He stopped paying attention to the years a long time ago.
You're Geryon, aren't you?
She asked.
Queen Cilla told us about you when she returned from Val Elorn last year. For some reason, I thought you were younger.
I was then. I've aged a bit this last year.
My name is Adara,
the tall girl introduced herself.
Queen Cilla asked me to show you the way to the main hall. Supper shall be ready soon.
Geryon inclined his head politely. In spite of the worry gnawing at him, he could not shake off the peculiar feeling that he ought to know this quiet, beautiful girl. Erend reached out and took the girl's hand, and the three of them passed hand in hand down the torchlit corridor. King Hohag's main hall was on a lower floor. It was a long, narrow room where chairs and padded benches sat in little clusters around braziers filled with glowing coals. Barak, holding a large ale tankard in one huge fist, was describing with some embellishment their descent from the top of the escarpment.
"We didn't really have any choice, you see. Tarugas had been frothing on our heels for several days, and we had to take the shortest way down."
Hetar nodded. "Plans sometimes have a way of changing when the unexpected crops up. That is why we put men to watching every known pass down from the top of the escarpment."
"I still think you might have let us know you were there."
Barak sounded a little injured. Hetar grinned wolfishly.
"We could not really take that chance, Barak. The Morgos might have seen us, and we did not want to frighten them off. It would have been a shame if they had gotten away, wouldn't it?"
"Is that all you ever think about?"
Hetar considered the question for a moment.
"Pretty much, yes," he admitted.
Supper was announced then, and they all moved to the long table at the far end of the hall. The general conversation at the table made it unnecessary for Geryon to lie directly to anyone about the frightening possibility Aunt Paul had raised, and after supper he sat beside Adara and lapsed into a kind of sleepy haze, only half listening to the talk. There was a stir at the door, and a guard entered.
"The priest of Belar,"
he announced in a loud voice, and a tall man in a white robe strode into the room, followed by four men dressed in shaggy furs. The four walked with a peculiar shuffling gait, and Geryon instantly recognized them as bear cultists, indistinguishable from the Kerak members of the same group he had seen in Val Elorn.
"Your Majesty,"
the man in the white robe boomed.
"Hail Kohag," the cultists intoned in unison, "chief of the clan chiefs of the Algars, and guardian of the southern reaches of Aloria."
King Kohag inclined his head briefly.
"What is it, Elvar?"
he asked the priest.
"I have come to congratulate your majesty upon the occasion of your great victory over the forces of the Dark God,"
the priest replied.
"You are most kind, Elvar,"
Kohag answered politely.
"Moreover," Elvar continued, "it has come to my attention that a holy object has come into the stronghold of the Algars. I presume that your majesty will wish to place it in the hands of the priesthood for safekeeping."
Geryon, alarmed at the priest's suggestion, half rose from his seat but stopped, not knowing how to voice his objection. Erend, however, with a confident smile, was already walking toward Elvar. The knots Durnek had so carefully tied were undone, and the child took the orb out of the pouch at his waist and offered it to the startled priest.
"Erend," he said.
Alvar's eyes bulged, and he recoiled from the orb, lifting his hands above his head to avoid touching it.
"Go ahead, Alvar,"
Bogora's voice came mockingly from the doorway.
"Let him who is without ill intent in the silence of his soul stretch forth his hand and take the orb."
"Lady Bulgara,"
the priest stammered,
"we thought that is I..."
"He seems to have some reservations," Silk suggested dryly. "Perhaps he has some lingering and deep-seated doubts about his own purity. That's a serious failing in a priest, I'd say." Elvar looked at the little man helplessly, his hands still held aloft.
"You should never ask for something you are not prepared to accept, Elvar,"
Polgara suggested.
"Lady Polgara, we thought that you'd be so busy caring for your father that..."
Elvar blurted, then faltered.
"That you could take possession of the orb before I knew about it? Think again, Elvar. I won't allow the orb to fall into the hands of the bear cult." She smiled rather sweetly at him then. "Unless you happen to be the one destined to wield it, of course. My father and I would both be overjoyed to hand the burden over to someone else. Why don't we find out? All you have to do is reach out your hand and take the orb."
Elvar's face blanched, and he backed away from Arand fearfully.
"I believe that will be all, Elvar,"
King Kohag said firmly. The priest looked about helplessly, then turned and quickly left the hall with his cultists close behind him.
"Make him put it away, Dernick,"
Polgara told the smith,
"and see if you can do something about those knots."
"I could seal him up with lead," Dernick mused. "Maybe that would keep him from getting it open."
"It might be worth a try."
Then she looked around.
"I thought you might all like to know that my father is awake. The old fool appears to be stronger than we thought."
Geryon, immediately alert, looked at her sharply, trying to detect some hint that she might not be telling them everything, but her calm face was totally unreadable.
Barak, laughing loudly with relief, slapped Hetar on the back. "I told you that he would be all right,"
he exclaimed delightedly. The others in the room were already crowding around Polgara, asking for details.
"He is awake," she told them. "That's about all I can say at the moment, except that he's his usual charming self. He's already complaining about lumps in the bed and demanding strong ale."
"I will send some at once,"
Queen Silar said.
"No, Silar,"
Polgara replied firmly.
"He gets broth, not ale."
"He won't like that much,"
Silk suggested. "Isn't that a shame?"
she smiled. She half turned, as if about to go back to the sick room, then stopped and looked rather quizzically at Geryon, who sat, relieved but still apprehensive, about Belgoroth's true condition beside Adara.
"I see that you have met your cousin," she observed.
"Who?"
"Don't sit there with your mouth open, Geryon," she advised him. "It makes you look like an idiot. Adara's the youngest daughter of your mother's sister. Haven't I ever told you about her?"
It all came crashing in on him.
"And Paul," he protested, "how could you forget something that important?"
But Adara, obviously as startled by the announcement as he had been, gave a low cry, put her arms about his neck, and kissed him warmly.
"Dear cousin,"
she exclaimed. Geryon flushed, then went pale, then flushed again. He stared first at Aunt Paul, then at his cousin, unable to speak or even to think coherently. Chapter 7. In the days that followed, while the others rested and Aunt Paul nursed Belgoroth back to health, Geryon and his cousin spent every waking moment together. From the time he had been a very small child, he had believed that Aunt Paul was his only family. Later, he had discovered that Mr. Wolf, Belgoroth, was also a relative, though infinitely far removed. But Adara, was different. She was nearly his own age, for one thing, and she seemed immediately to fill that void that had always been there. She became at once all of those sisters and cousins and younger aunts that others seemed to have, but that he did not. She showed him the Algar stronghold from top to bottom. As they wandered together down long, empty corridors, they frequently held each other's hands. Most of the time, however, they talked. They sat together in out-of-the-way places with their heads close together, talking, laughing, exchanging confidences, and opening their hearts to each other. Geryon discovered a hunger for talk in himself that he had not suspected. The circumstances of the past year had made him reticent, and now all that flood of words broke loose. Because he loved his tall, beautiful cousin, he told her things he would not have told to any other living soul. Adara responded to his affection with a love of her own that seemed as deep, and she listened to his outpourings with an attention that made him reveal himself even more.
"Can you really do that?"
she asked, when, one bright winter afternoon, they sat together in an embrasure high up in the fortress wall, with a window behind them overlooking the vast sea of winter-brown grass stretching to the horizon.
"Are you really a sorcerer?"
"I'm afraid so."
"Afraid?"
"Well, there are some pretty awful things involved in it, Adara. At first I didn't want to believe it, but things kept happening because I wanted them to happen. It finally reached the point where I couldn't doubt it anymore."
"Show me,"
she urged him.
He looked around a bit nervously. "I don't really think that I should," he apologized. "It makes a certain kind of noise, you see, and Aunt Paul can hear it. For some reason, I don't think she'd approve if I just did it to show off."
"You're not afraid of her, are you?"
"Well, it's not exactly that. I just don't want her to be disappointed in me."
He considered that.
"Let me see if I can explain. We had an awful argument once, and Nyssa, I said some things I didn't really mean, and she told me exactly what she'd gone through for me."
He looked somberly out of the window, remembering Aunt Paul's words on the steamy deck of Greldick's ship.
"She has devoted 1,000 years to me, Adara. To my family, actually. But finally, all because of me. She has given up every single thing that's ever been important to her for me. Can you imagine the kind of obligation that puts on me? I'll do anything she wants me to. I'd cut off my arm before I'd ever hurt her again."
"You love her very much, don't you, Gary?"
"It goes beyond that. I don't think there's even been a word invented yet to describe what exists between us."
Wordlessly, Adara took his hand, her eyes warm with a wondering affection. Later that afternoon, Geryon went alone to the room where Aunt Paul was caring for her recalcitrant patient. After the first few days of bed rest, Belgarath had steadily grown more testy about his enforced confinement. Traces of that irritability lingered on his face even as he dozed, propped up by many pillows in the canopied bed. Aunt Paul, wearing her familiar gray dress, sat nearby, her needle busy as she altered one of Geryon's old tunics for errand. The little boy, sitting not far away, watched her with that serious expression that always seemed to make him look older than he really was.
"How is he?"
Geryon asked, looking at his sleeping grandfather.
"Improving,"
Aunt Paul replied, setting aside the tunic.
"His temper's getting worse. That's always a good sign." "Are there any hints that he might be getting back his... well, you know?"
Geryon gestured vaguely.
"No,"
she replied.
"Nothing yet. Probably too early."
"Will you two stop that whispering?"
Belgarath demanded without opening his eyes.
"How can I possibly sleep with all of that going on?"
"You were the one who said he didn't want to sleep,"
Bulger reminded him.
"That was before,"
he snapped back, his eyes popping open. He looked at Geryon.
"Where have you been?"
"Geryon has been getting acquainted with his cousin Adara,"
Aunt Paul explained. "He could stop by to visit me once in a while," the old man complained.
"There is not much entertainment in listening to you snore, Father."
"I do not snore, Polgara."
"Whatever you say, Father,"
she agreed placidly. "Don't patronize me, Paul."
"Oh, of course not, Father. Now, how would you like a nice hot cup of broth?"
"I would not like a nice hot cup of broth. I want meat, rare, red meat, and a cup of strong ale."
"But you won't get meat and ale, Father. You will get what I decide to give you, and right now it's broth and milk."
"Milk?"
"Would you prefer gruel?"
The old man glared indignantly at her, and Geryon quietly left the room. After that, Belgarath's recovery was steady. A few days later he was out of bed, though Polgara raised some apparently strenuous objections. Geryon knew them both well enough to see directly to the core of his aunt's behavior. Prolonged bed rest had never been her favorite form of therapy. She had always wanted her patients ambulatory as soon as possible. By seeming to want to coddle her irascible father, she had quite literally forced him out of bed. Even beyond that, the precisely calibrated restrictions she imposed on his movements were deliberately designed to anger him, to goad his mind to activity. Never anything more than he could handle at any given time, but always just enough to force his mental recovery to keep pace with his physical recuperation. Her careful manipulation of the old man's convalescence stepped beyond the mere practice of medicine into the realm of art. When Belgarath first appeared in King Kohag's hall, he looked shockingly weak. He seemed actually to totter as he leaned heavily on Aunt Paul's arm. But a bit later, when the conversation began to interest him, there were hints that this apparent fragility was not wholly genuine. The old man was not above a bit of self-dramatization once in a while, and he soon demonstrated that no matter how skillfully Aunt Paul played, he could play too. It was marvelous to watch the two of them subtly maneuvering around each other in their elaborate little game. The final question, however, still remained unanswered. Belgarath's physical and mental recovery now seemed certain, but his ability to bring his will to bear had not yet been tested. That test, Geryon knew, would have to wait. Quite early one morning, perhaps a week after they had arrived at the stronghold, Adara tapped at the door of Geryon's room. Even as he came awake, he knew it was she. "Yes," he said through the door, quickly pulling on his shirt and hose.
"Would you like to ride today, Geryon?"
she asked.
"The sun's out, and it's a little warmer."
"Of course," he agreed immediately, setting to pull on the Algar boots Hetar had given to him.
"Let me get dressed. I'll be just a minute." "There's no great hurry," she told him. "I'll have a horse saddled for you and get some food from the kitchen. You should probably tell Lady Polgara where you're going, though. I'll meet you in the west stables."
"I won't be long," he promised. Aunt Paul was seated in the great hall with Belgarath and King Kohag, while Queen Silar sat nearby, her fingers flickering through warp and woof on a large loom upon which she was weaving. The click of the shuttle was a peculiarly drowsy sort of sound.
"Travel's going to be difficult in midwinter," King Kohag was saying. "It will be savage in the mountains of Urgo."
"I think there's a way we can avoid all of that," Belgarath replied lazily.
He was lounging deeply in a large chair.
"We will go back to Prolgo the way we came. But I need to talk to Ralg. Do you suppose you could send for him?"
Kohag nodded and gestured to a serving man. He spoke briefly to him as Belgarath negligently hung one leg over the arm of his chair and settled in even deeper. The old man was wearing a soft gray woolen tunic. Although it was early, he held a tankard of ale.
"Don't you think you are overdoing that a bit?"
Aunt Paul asked him, looking pointedly at the tankard.
"I have to regain my strength, Paul,"
he explained innocently.
and strong ale restores the blood. You seem to forget that I am still practically an invalid.
I wonder how much of your invalidism is coming out of Kohag's ale barrel. You looked terrible when you came down this morning.
Oh, but I'm feeling much better now, though, he smiled, taking another drink.
Oh, yes, I'm sure you are. Yes, Geryon? Adara wants me to go riding with her,
Geryon said.
She thought I should tell you where I was going?
Queen Silar smiled gently at him.
You've stolen away my favorite lady-in-waiting, Geryon,
she told him.
I'm sorry, Geryon quickly replied. If you need her, we won't go.
I was only teasing you, the queen laughed. Go ahead, enjoy your ride.
Relg came into the hall just then, and not far behind him, Taiba. The Marag woman, once she had bathed and had been given decent clothes to wear, had surprised them all. She was no longer the hopeless, dirty slave woman they had found in the caves beneath Rachthol. Her figure was full and her skin very pale. She moved with a kind of unconscious grace, and King Kohag's clansmen looked after her as she passed, their lips pursed speculatively. She seemed to know she was being watched, and, far from being offended by the fact, it seemed rather to please her and to increase her self-confidence. Her violet eyes glowed, and she smiled often now. She was, however, never very far from Relg. At first, Geryon had believed that she was deliberately placing herself where the Ulgo would have to look at her out of a perverse enjoyment of the discomfort it caused him. But now he was not so sure. She no longer even seemed to think about it, but followed Relg wherever he went, seldom speaking, but always there.
"You sent for me, Belgareth?" Relg asked.
Some of the harshness had gone out of his voice, but his eyes still looked peculiarly haunted.
"Ah, Relg," Belgareth said expansively. "There's a good fellow. Come, sit down. Take a cup of ale." "Water, thank you," Relg replied firmly. "As you wish," Belgareth shrugged. "I was wondering, do you by any chance know a route through the caves of Ulgo that reaches from Prolgu to the southern edge of the land of the Sindars?" "That's a very long way," Relg told him. "Not nearly as long as it would be if we rode over the mountains," Belgareth pointed out. "There is no snow in the caves, no monsters. Is there such a way?"
"There is,"
Relg admitted.
"And would you be willing to guide us?"
the old man pressed.
"If I must,"
Relg agreed with some reluctance.
"I think you must, Relg," Belgareth told him.
Relg sighed.
"I'd hoped that I could return home now that the journey's almost over," he said regretfully.
Belgareth laughed.
"Actually, our journey's only just started, Relg. We have a long way yet to go."
Taiba smiled a slow, pleased little smile at that. Geryon felt a small hand slip into his, and he smiled down at Erend, who had just come into the hall.
"Is it all right, Aunt Paul?"
he asked.
"If I go riding, I mean." "Of course, dear. Just be careful. Do not try to show off for Adara. I don't want you falling off a horse and breaking anything."
Erend let go of Geryon's hand, and walked over to where Relg stood. The knots on the pouch that Durnik had so carefully sealed with lead were undone again, and the little boy took the orb out and offered it to Relg.
"Erend?"
he said.
"Why don't you take it, Relg?"
Taiba asked the startled man.
"No one in the world questions your purity."
Relg stepped back and shook his head.
"The orb is the holy object of another religion," he declared. "It is from Aldur, not Ul, so it would not be proper for me to touch it."
Taiba smiled knowingly, her violet eyes intent on the zealot's face.
"Erend,"
Aunt Paul said,
"come here."
Obediently he went to her. She took hold of the pouch at his belt and held it open.
Put it away, she told him. Aaron sighed and deposited the orb in the pouch. How does he manage to keep getting this open? She said, half to herself as she examined the strings of the pouch. Geryon and Adara rode out from the stronghold into the rolling hills to the west. The sky was a deep blue, and the sunlight was very bright. Although the morning was crisp, it was not nearly as cold as it had been for the past week or so. The grass beneath their horses' hooves was brown and lifeless, lying dormant under the winter sky. They rode together without speaking for an hour or so, and finally they stopped and dismounted on the sunny south side of a hill where there was a shelter from the stiff breeze. They sat together looking out at the featureless miles of the Algarian plain.
"How much can actually be done with sorcery, Geryon?"
she asked after a long silence. He shrugged.
"It depends on who's doing it. Some people are very powerful. Others can hardly do anything at all." "Could you?"
she hesitated.
"Could you make this bush bloom?"
she went on quickly, and he knew that was not the question she had originally intended to ask.
"Right now, I mean. In the middle of wintertime."
Geryon looked at the dry, scrubby bit of gorse, putting the sequence of what he'd have to do together.
"I suppose I could. But if I did that in the wrong season, the bush wouldn't have any defense against the cold. It would die." "It is only a bush, Geryon. Why kill it?"
She avoided his eyes.
"Could you make something happen for me, Geryon? Some small thing. I need something to believe in. Very much so right now."
"I could try, I guess." He did not understand her suddenly somber mood.
"How about something like this?"
He picked up a twig and turned it over in his hands, looking carefully at it. Then he wrapped several strands of dry grass around it and studied it again, until he had what he wanted to do firmly in his mind. When he released his will on it, he did not do it all at once, so the change was gradual. Adara's eyes widened as the sorry-looking clump of twig and dry grass was transmuted before her. It really wasn't much of a flower. It was a kind of pale lavender color, and it was distinctly lopsided. It was quite small, and its petals were not very firmly attached. Its fragrance, however, was sweet, with all of the promise of summer. Geryon felt very strange as he wordlessly handed the flower to his cousin. The sound of it had not been that rushing noise he had always associated with sorcery, but rather was very much like the bell tone he had heard in the glowing cave when he had given life to the colt. And when he had begun to focus his will, he had not drawn anything from his surroundings. It had all come from within him, and there had been a deep and peculiar joy in it.
"It's lovely,"
Adara said, holding the little flower gently in her cupped hands and inhaling its fragrance. Her dark hair fell across her cheek, hiding her face from him. Then she lifted her chin, and Geryon saw that her eyes were filled with tears.
"It seems to help," she said. "For a little while, anyway." "What's wrong, Adara?"
She did not answer, but looked out across the dun brown plain.
"Who is Senedra?"
she asked suddenly.
"I have heard the others mention her." "Senedra? She's an imperial princess, the daughter of Ran Barun of Tolnedra." "What is she like?" "Very small. She's part dryad. She has red hair and green eyes and a bad temper. She's a spoiled little brat. She doesn't like me very much."
"But you could change that, couldn't you?"
Adara laughed suddenly and wiped at the tears.
"I'm not sure I follow you." "All you'd have to do is..."
She made a vague kind of gesture. "Oh," he caught her meaning.
"No, we can't do very much with other people's thoughts and feelings. What I mean is, well, there's nothing to get hold of.
I wouldn't even know where to start.
Adara looked at him for a moment, then she buried her face in her hands and began to cry.
What's the matter?
He asked, alarmed.
Nothing, she said. It's not important.
It is important.
Why are you crying? I'd hoped. When I first heard that you were a sorcerer, and then when you made this flower, I thought you could do anything. I thought that maybe you might be able to do something for me.
Well, I'd do anything you ask, Adara. You know that.
But you can't, Garion. You just said so yourself.
What was it that you wanted me to do?
I thought that perhaps you might be able to make somebody fall in love with me. Isn't that a foolish idea?
Who? She looked at him with a quiet dignity, her eyes still full of tears.
It doesn't really matter, does it? You can't do anything about it, and neither can I. It was just a foolish notion. I know better now. Why don't we just forget that I ever said anything about it?
She rose to her feet.
Let's go back now. It's not nearly as nice a day as I thought, and I am starting to get cold.
They remounted and rode in silence back toward the looming walls of the stronghold. They did not speak any more. Adara did not wish to talk, and Garion did not know what to say. Behind them, forgotten, lay the flower that he had created. Protected by the slope and faintly warmed by the winter sun, the flower that had never existed before swelled with silent vegetative ecstasy and bore its fruit. A tiny seed pod at its heart opened, scattering infinitesimal seeds that sifted down to the frozen earth through the stalks of winter grass, and there they lay, awaiting spring. Chapter 8 The Ulgo girls had pale skin, white blonde hair and huge dark eyes. Princess Tenedra sat in the midst of them like a single red rose in a garden of lilies. They watched her every move with a sort of gentle astonishment, as if overwhelmed by this vibrant little stranger who had quite suddenly become the center of their lives. It was not merely her coloring, though, that was astonishing enough. Ulgos, by nature, were a serious, reserved people, seldom given to laughter or outward displays of emotion. Tenedra, however, lived, as always, on the extreme outside of her skin. They watched, enthralled, the flicker and play of mood and emotion across her exquisite little face. They blushed and giggled nervously at her outrageous and often wicked little jokes. She drew them into confidences, and each of the dozen or so who had become her constant companions had at one time or another opened her heart to the little princess. There were bad days, of course. Days when Tenedra was out of sorts, impatient, willful, and when she drove the gentle-eyed Ulgo girls from her with a savage vituperation, sending them fleeing in tears from her unexplained tantrums. Later, though, they all resolved, after such stormy outbursts, never to go near her again. Then they would hesitantly return to find her smiling and laughing, as if nothing at all had happened. It was a difficult time for the princess. She had not fully realized the implications of her unhesitating acquiescence to the command of Ul, when he had told her to remain behind in the caves while the others journeyed to Rachtol. For her entire life, Tenedra had been at the center of events. But here she was, shunted into the background, forced to endure the tedious passage of hours, spent doing nothing but waiting. She was not emotionally constructed for waiting, and the outbursts that scattered her companions like startled doves were at least in part generated by her enforced inactivity. The wild swings of her moods were particularly trying for the Gorum. The frail, ancient holy man had lived for centuries a life of quiet contemplation, and Zenedra had exploded into the middle of that quiet like a comet. Though sometimes tried to the very limits of his patience, he endured the fits of bad temper, the storms of weeping, the unexplained outbursts, and just as patiently her sudden exuberant displays of affection, when she would throw her arms about his neck and cover his startled face with kisses. On those days, when Zenedra's mood was congenial, she gathered her companions among the columns on the shore of the Gorham's Island to talk, laugh, and play the little games she had invented, and the dim, silent cavern was filled with babble and laughter of adolescent girls. When her mood was pensive, she and the Gorham sometimes took short walks to view the strange splendors of this subterranean world of cave and gallery and cavern beneath the abandoned city of Prolgu. To the unpracticed eye, it might have appeared that the princess was so involved in her own emotional pyrotechnics that she was oblivious to anything around her. But such was not the case. Her complex little mind was quite capable of observing, analyzing, and questioning, even in the very midst of an outburst. To the Gorham's surprise, he found her mind quick and retentive. When he told her the stories of his people, she questioned him closely, moving always to the meaning that lay behind the stories. The princess made many discoveries during those talks. She discovered that the core of Urgo life was religion, and that the moral and theme of all of their stories was the duty of absolute submission to the will of Ul. A Tol Nedran might quibble, or even try to strike bargains with his god. Nedra expected it, and seemed to enjoy the play of offer and counter-offer, as much as did his people. The Ulgo mind, however, was incapable of such casual familiarity. "We are nothing," the Gorham explained, "less than nothing. We had no place and no god, but wandered outcast in the world until Ul consented to become our god. Some of the zealots have even gone so far as to suggest that if one single Ulgo displeases our god, he will withdraw himself from us. I don't pretend to know the mind of Ul entirely, but I don't think he's quite that unreasonable. Still, he didn't really want to be our god in the first place, so it is best probably not to offend him."
"He loves you," Tenedra pointed out quickly. "Anyone could see that in his face when he came to us that time."
The Gorham looked doubtful. "I hope I have not disappointed him too much."
"But don't be silly,"
the princess said airily.